You're listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer. My guest for episode 240 is Jonathan Rundman. Jonathan has released at least 10 solo albums since 1992. You're right, you know, hearing When I Get Bored from his first album, 11 Years and 28 Days in the Yellow Room. In the second half of the 90s, he was briefly in a group called the Muckrakers. He has played in a Finnish folk ensemble called Kaivama, and he's played on multiple solo albums by the Silos frontman Walter Salas-Humara, a relationship that continued as the Silos have come back together in recent years. And he wrote with Walter the first song that we will be talking about today, Diner by the Train, as released on his new album, Waves. And we'll look back to Home Unknown from Jonathan's last solo album, 2015's Look Up. Then we'll look back to one of his early albums, 1997's Recital, and discuss the song Tape. As a little bonus, we're going to throw in a short song called A Failing Rockstar Attempt from his Sound Theology album from the year 2000. And we'll conclude by listening to another song from the new album, Waves, called Evidence. For more information, please see jonathanrundman.com. For more about this podcast, see nakedlyexaminedmusic.com or support the effort and get your episodes ad-free at patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. When I get bored, I wonder if I am just unproductive. I will play a little bit of When I Get Bored from 11 Years and 28 Days in the Yellow Room, your first album to kick things off. We're going to get pretty quickly to the new stuff, but do you want to give the fast version of the journey from there, starting out?
I made this album right after I turned 21, and I recorded it on a Tascam cassette four-track machine, and the drums are a Roland 505 drum machine, and I'm playing everything else.
On the new album, we're going to hear you record in a very different way, that you had a live band. It seems like you play everything except drums in general in your albums.
I play some drums on the records too, although I'm very bad. I'm a very poor drummer, but I can play mid-tempo, trashy drums. I can't play fast and I can't play slow. But in this period of my life, when I was so young, it was called 28 Days in the Yellow Room because I was in an apartment building. We had an extra room that was my four-track studio.
This is Portland or Eugene? Where was this?
Eugene, Oregon. Yep. And I was a newlywed. I had just got married. And we had just moved to the West Coast from the Midwest. And I had 10 songs, that my first kind of batch of 10 original songs. And I thought, I got to make a record. I was playing gigs already. So I made this. I took 28 days of overdubbing in my extra room and created this record. And then I manufactured cassette tapes. And that was the first record.
All right. So you've been DIY, at least DIY capable, since those days.
The entire time. Yep.
So when you've gotten down to do the more polished solo albums, were you just having those mixed elsewhere? Were you actually having the drums recorded in studio? So talk about sort of the evolution of how you're recording these things before we hear the new thing.
Yeah, the only album of mine that I ever mixed myself was this first one, the cassette four-track album, and then Sound Theology record from 2000, I mixed some of myself. I don't know anything about mixing. I don't have any gear. I don't know about reverbs and compression. And so when I mix, it's pretty much just volume and faders and crossing my fingers and bouncing it, you know. The records that have gotten me good attention, my most professional albums, I always send the tracks off to be mixed by a professional.
All right. Well, on this one, on Waves, you have everything done. And your press release had said that these were, for the most part, recorded live as a four-piece. Is that the case here? Or were you playing an acoustic that got then stripped out? Or were you playing the piano live? Or how did this one?
Are you talking about the Waves album on the new?
Yeah. So we're going to talk about A Diner by the Train specifically, we're about to hear.
Yes. So the Waves album, it was sort of the most classic experience in the studio that I'd ever had. And I really wanted to orchestrate it that way. So it was the four main band members playing live in the studio in Nashville with no click track and just going live to a 2-inch reel-to-reel analog tape. And I had never made a record like that before. It was so exciting and old school. And then because there was only four of us and I play a lot of instruments, the Nashville sessions was two guitars, bass, and drums. And then I overdubbed all the keyboard stuff here in Minneapolis because all my vintage keyboards are here at home, not in Nashville where we made the record. And so when you hear the songs from the Waves album, what you are hearing is the four of us in the room. And then if there's keyboards, it's overdubbed. But it's interesting, if you're starting with Diner by the Train, what happened with that one was we made the Nashville version of it, which was kind of an Americana thing with acoustic guitar and kind of twangy electric guitar. And then when I came home to add the piano part, I played the piano in my living room on my Baldwin Acrosonic piano. And I thought the piano part turned out so beautifully that I muted the guitars.
Okay.
And sent it to my producer. I was like, listen to how this sounds with the Nashville stuff muted. And he was like, oh my gosh, let's totally go that direction. And so then we built it around my overdubbed piano. And then Eric, the lead guitarist, played a brand new spacey guitar part over the piano. The vinyl record version of the song was kind of created after the fact because the piano part was so commanding that it changed the focus of the whole thing. But then, you know, when the time came to manufacture compact discs, you know, you have a lot more time. There's 80 minutes on a CD. And I thought, I wonder what it would be like if I went back and listened to the Nashville tracks. So we muted the Minneapolis stuff, turned up the Nashville tracks, and those were really good too. And so there's a bonus track on the CD where you can hear the four people in Nashville playing together. It's called the Nashville Guitars Mix.
All right. Well, I will link folks to that. Let's go ahead and hear the main version.
Samuel met Jessica on a cold and windy day. Sam worked as a banker for the Morgan Guarantee. He would go for coffee on his way into the city. Jesse was the owner of the Diner by the Train. Diner by the Train, by the Train. Flesh and blood and bone are gone, it will remain. Diner by the Train, by the Train. See it through the window every day. He would wear a charcoal suit and a starched ivory shirt. She would wear an apron and tie up her long hair. Samuel, he fell in love with Jessica with all his heart. And all the while, Jesse loved the Diner by the Train. Diner by the Train, by the Train. When flesh and blood and bone are gone, it will remain. The park. They made love at the hotel in the dark. In good time, their child was born on a cold and windy day. Samuel, he quit his job to stay home with the boy. Jessica went back to work, and how she loved that baby. But even so, she could not leave the Diner by the Train. Diner by the Train, by the Train. When flesh and blood and bone are gone, it will remain. Diner Train, see it through the window every day. Jesse had a heart condition, never saw it coming. Now she's in the churchyard where they married years before. Sam works at the diner. He tries to keep it running. And he tells his boy, when I am gone, all of this is yours. Yeah, he tells his boy, when I am gone, all of this is yours. Diner by the train, when flesh and blood and bone are gone, it will remain. Diner by the train, see it through the window every day. See it through the window every day.
So I know this was the tune you picked for this from the new album, but I know it is not actually a composition originating with the new album, that this was written way back in 2016.
Yes.
With Walter from the Silos. So how did this co-write work?
I've been kind of collaborating with Walter ever since 2003 when we recorded my album Public Library, and Walter was my producer for that album. And so then over the years, you know, I would see Walter and hang out with him and like sit in with the Silos if they were on a tour or something. And then in 2014, Walter was had retired the name of the band, the Silos, and he was out on tour as a solo troubadour, singer-songwriter under his own name. And he asked me and Eric Castle if we would play acoustic shows with him. Eric is a fantastic lead guitarist who lives here in Minneapolis with me. And so Eric and I started touring with Walter as a trio. And that was just so fun. And the three of us just sounded amazing together. And we could do triple harmony vocals and stuff. And then Walter one day just sent me an email and said, hey, I've got this idea for a song. Do you want to help me finish it? And it was Diner by the Train. And so he had the title and he had the characters with the people's names and he had the basic plot line. And Walter's starting place was he wanted to write a song about a stay-at-home dad. And he knew that I had done that gig. You know, when my kids were babies, I spent 6 years at home changing diapers and doing the stay-home dad routine. And so he knew that about me. And so he said, hey, you've done this. Why can you help me finish this song? And I was, of course, thrilled because, you know, I get a chance to write with one of my all-time most influential artists. And so I took Walter's lyric ideas and I wrote the music part of it. So I wrote the verses and the melody lines. And then I took his plot line and characters and made the lines rhyme and fit into the meter of the song. And then I sent it back to him and I said, what do you think? Is this going the right direction? And he said, yeah, but let's make the chorus twice as long. So then he added some stuff on the chorus. And I thought, wow, this is great. And then we played the whole thing, or made a demo or something, and listened to the demo of the whole thing. And he's like, you know, this is good, but it's not done yet. He said, something needs to happen. Somebody needs to die.
Okay.
And then we wrote the fourth verse. And then once we wrote the fourth verse, we were like, wow, that is exactly what needed to happen. So Walter's instinct, he knew that the emotional gravity of the song was not heightened enough. The stakes needed to be higher. And when he had that idea to add the fourth verse and we crafted the end of the song, I just thought, wow, I had never been a part of a song anything like this before. I don't write narrative songs. I don't write songs with a plot. I don't write songs with characters, with people's names. This was totally different for me. And it turned out to be, I think, absolutely beautiful. And then Walter recorded it on his record in 2016 called Explodes and Disappears. And then I played piano and sang the harmonies on the Walter version. At that point, it's been 10 years since I made a solo album. And so I always thought the next time I make a Jonathan Runman album, I'm going to do my own version of Diner by the Train. And so that's what you are hearing on the Waves album. I finally, after almost a decade, had a chance to do my own interpretation of this song I wrote with Walter.
Well, let me insert 20 seconds or so of the Walter version, just so people can hear how the feel is different.
Into the city, Jesse was the owner of the diner by the train. Diner by the train, by the train.
So, I mean, it's a full 2 minutes longer. All of the Spanish guitar noodling, quite a different. Yours is much more, and it's interesting to hear that the way you wrote the chorus was even shorter, that it seems like your version was very sort of baroque and to the point and somber in a way that his is a little more, got a little more flourish. When the chorus comes, it pops out a little more. I like both of them.
Yeah, they're totally different. And in fact, I think the groove, I think one of them is cut time and one of them, I think mine is mine cut in half? I don't know, but it's two opposite grooves. And mine actually goes by faster, but the tempo is cut in half, I think is how it works. In my mind, I'm playing it like a Simon and Garfunkel song, whereas Walter's doing it like a Hispanic rock kind of thing.
Yes, and he has the three-part harmony. It makes it sound 70s a la, you know, Eagles, CSN kind of thing. Whereas as on so much of your stuff, you've got that doing your own backing vocal, that high thing that it seems like that is just an extension of your being that you that you sing in two parts almost invariably.
Yeah, I love harmony vocals and I tend to overdo them. I just pile them on all the time. So on the Walter album, that's me singing on the Walter version.
But both of the extra harmonies, or is he doing one of them, or do you recall?
It's either me doing them all, or it's me and Eric Castle doing it. I can't remember.
I don't know how much of this Walter is responsible for, but clearly you had the When Flesh and Blood and Bone Are Gone in the song before you introduced the death part at the end, right?
The Flesh and Blood and Bone Are Gone is the part Walter added to the chorus to make it longer. Because I think when I sent him the first try at the music of the song, it was like Diner by the Train, See It Through the Window Every Day or something. It was like half as long. Walter added that part about flesh and blood and bone, which I would have never thought of. But it, once again, what it's doing is it's raising the stakes. It's making the mortality of it all more intense. I really feel like, man, I've learned so much from Walter. I mean, he was one of my heroes when I was a teenager. But now to work with him as a colleague, I think I've really learned that there's a value in raising the stakes in songwriting, and there's a value in taking emotional risks and then being kind of unabashed or just unapologetically emotionally vulnerable.
And building those stakes around this seemingly mundane, concrete thing. Like, what is there about even just the image of Diner by the Train? It just in the abstract means nothing to me.
Right.
So this is why... Like, why is this the focus of their world and the song, and it's made into this sort of semi-religious object, even though there's nothing that's said about the diner of what makes it special or something.
Right. Yeah, I think I just love this song because it's so unusual, and I think what's so cool about it is there's not many songs about a father who chooses to stay home with the child, and there's also not many songs about a small business owner. And really, this is I think of this song as a movie. Like, I always tell Walter, like, this song isn't a song, it's a movie. And sometimes when I play it live, I'll tell the audience, you know, hey, this is a song from my new record. It's called Diner by the Train. I wrote it with Walter. And I tell the audience, this song is a movie. And then I play it. And it's funny, when I'm playing it live, I see the movie in my mind, you know, and I don't have any other songs really that are so narrative and plot driven, just because that's not my own songs don't turn out that way. But it is so interesting that, you know, it's this song, it's got a setting, it's got a location. I picture the Diner by the Train being in like Schaumburg, Illinois, Naperville, because I used to live in Chicago. So I can imagine like the people who take the commuter train from the western suburbs into Chicago every day. In my mind, that's what it is. But Walter is from New York. So I'm sure when he wrote it, he was thinking of like the Hudson River, like someone who lives up in Westchester County and they get on the train and they go into, you know, whatever that, what's the big station in New York City called?
Do they even call them diners in the Chicago area?
Yeah, right. Because diner is an East Coast term. Yes. Like in New Jersey has diners and New York City has diners. I mean, I think they do. I mean, I'm a Midwesterner. I think they're called diners. But it's really like, I'm sure for Walter... It's an East Coast song. And know what I love about the song too is the song is a period piece. And I didn't realize that until I looked it up after the song was written. But Walter says he worked as a banker at the Morgan Guarantee. That's Morgan Stanley, the bank. Mm-hmm. It was called the Morgan Guarantee in the 70s. And then the company was bought and it changed into Morgan Stanley or something else in the 80s. And so it wasn't the Morgan Guarantee. The only time it was Morgan Guarantee was like 50 years ago or 40 years ago. So... If that's true about Samuel in the song, then the song takes place in the 70s, which is pretty cool.
Let me insert some of the bridge here.
They married at the big church by the park. They made love at the hotel.
So I just wanted to play that transition to get out of that, which is the place where Walter's version, there's way more in there. For you, what does that do to the mood? You've had this sort of somber mood the whole time. It turns major when we get to the pretty chorus. And then we have just kind of a dreamy thing. I mean, it's furthering the plot, but like, what does this do mood-wise for you and in terms of how you're resolving that, as opposed to having it spin off into some sort of dreamland?
Right. Well, I made a conscious decision when I did my version of this song that I wanted it to be a lot shorter than the Walter version. And whenever I tour with Walter, we've played this song a million times on the Walter tours and on the Silos tours. And when we do it live, it's even longer. Like sometimes it's like 8 minutes long, and we do the chorus in three-part harmony about five times at the end. And then there's an a cappella chorus.
Well, because you have the a cappella version. Yep.
Yeah. We go to an a cappella chorus because Eric and I can do the really cool Crosby, Stills, and Nash vocal suspensions above Walter's lead. And it really, and the audience, it's so interesting for me to be the co-writer of this, but to primarily play it with Walter, because the audience just hangs on it. You know, it's such a, the storyline is so commanding. And Walter is such a powerful performer that he sells it really hard as a performer. And so whenever we get to that a cappella chorus at the end, I mean, the audience is just transfixed. And then when we finish it, the audience goes crazy, you know, because it's just such a powerful song. And it's always been fun for me to like stand in the back as the sideman, watching the audience respond to Walter doing this song. But it's really epic. When he does it, it just goes and goes. So I thought, I want to do the concise version. No solos, almost no introduction, no repeated choruses at the end. I just want to get in there and blast through the whole thing and get out.
And did you talk in terms of the collaboration when you're saying, okay, so he added two lines and you added two lines, but is it part of that like a discussion of what are we trying to say here? What is the tone? What is this? Or is it just like, I interpret the words and I spit some back and then he likes them or doesn't like them? And
the beginning part of the process was just a volley back and forth. He sent me the words and the plot and the characters. I sent him the musical structure. He liked it. He sent back a longer chorus. I thought, that's awesome. I sent back a bridge, and it was just volleying back and forth with like phone calls and emails. Or then we'd make an acoustic demo and email the little sketchy demo to the other person. But the time we had to actually sit down and talk about, what are we trying to do here? What is the point of this? What's the emotional significance of this? Is when we realized it needed a fourth verse. Somebody's got to die. And that was the moment where we actually had to have a heart-to-heart and say, this song is, it's going to be just too boring or insignificant unless we raise the stakes. I've co-written with people in my life on and off, but this was really exciting and fun collaboration, kind of creative work, and especially for me to work with someone who's just such a fantastic artist.
And it's interesting with the narrative in that last verse that you don't say when the death happens.
Right.
Is it when the kid is 3? Is it when the kid is 20?
What, exactly. You know, right.
When I am gone, why is the father, after, you know, the kid has lost his mother, emphasizing that I'm going to die too? Why this emphasis on mortality?
Right. I think, yeah, mortality is the whole thing. But I think the interesting tone about, like, Walter and I aren't, I don't think we tried to do this. It's just how it worked out. But the song ends up saying, like, this diner, this small business is so stable that it's going to outlive the mother and it's going to outlive the father. And years into the future, the son is going to inherit the family business. You know, and I also think that's another thing, like, family businesses are a thing. That's a really important part of American life. It's many, many families have a family business or a family farm. And the inheriting of the family business is an extremely fraught and serious and sometimes painful part of life. And so in this story, the son is being told, when I'm gone, this is yours. You're going to maintain this business that your mother loved so much.
Yes. In every other part of American life, telling your children what they're going to do with their lives is plain old not acceptable. Though, you know, there's, oh, you're going to be a doctor, et cetera, whatever. There's an especially poignant it's been in many pieces of literature. Are you going to take up my mantle, or are you going to reject the whole thing and spit on my grave?
Exactly. Yeah. Will you take up the mantle? I mean, this is ancient drama. Mm-hmm. Ancient family drama. Will the next generation take up the mantle? So I think, like, for a song that is totally about mundane everyday life and regular people in a regular suburb, it has so much pathos, you know, and I think that's what's special about the song is that it's, if you really dig in, there's a lot to check out about this song.
Yes. Even though, just like the timeline is missing, the kid's reaction to this is missing.
Right.
So you read the pathos into it. You know, it's not, we're not going to give you an actual scene, which another song might just be a scene. Even right in that bridge that I played, they made love at the hotel in the dark, as if the dark is standing in for something.
Yes.
To say that there's something a little thin or miserable or something about their relationship, that it is dwarfed by the business ownership. I'm not sure exactly what's being said there, but right. It's just, it seems like a sort of a spooky delivery for what it is, for what it actually says.
Right. I love this song for a lot of reasons, but it's the only song that I have that has a sex scene. Walter had sent me the plot line of the song when he started it, and it had this thing. Okay, they get married at the big church, and then they go to the hotel and they make love and all this stuff. And I thought to myself when I got the lyrics, I thought, wow, you know, I'm going to create a song out of this plot line. And so I was the one, if I remember correct, who added by the park and in the dark. They married at the big church by the park and made love in the hotel, but because I like a really obvious rhyme. And also to change the melody, to change the chords, that bridge has a totally different musical form that doesn't exist anywhere else in the song. And I think it's the moment, it's the conception of the boy. So they conceive the child after their wedding, and it's like a very pivotal moment. So the whole music changes. And I think the great thing is once we added the fourth verse, the bridge then sits in the dead center because you have two mm-hmm. verses, and then the bridge where the child is conceived, and then you get the two more verses at the end. And now that bridge sits as the pivotal central moment. So I love the thematic part of that as well.
Hey, let's talk about some sponsors. First of which is Square. Your favorite neighborhood spots run on Square. I'm talking the little bars that you like to see shows at, or maybe your band plays at. I'm talking about your record stores, your independently owned coffee shops, maybe the music store where people go take piano lessons and guitar lessons in the back room, or the kind of place where you take your guitar in to get a tune-up. Pretty much your whole local music scene is made up of these small neighborhood businesses, many of which run on Square. And we need to support these local businesses, because I don't know about where you live, but the odds of your band getting to play at the Cheesecake Factory or Target are pretty much nil. When your neighborhood businesses thrive, the whole neighborhood thrives. You spend money in the neighborhood, it stays in the neighborhood. They give you a reason to leave the house. Square is a proud partner of more than 4 million neighborhood businesses around the world, and I want you to take this ad as an excuse for you to go support your favorite local spot. You can go to square.com/go/NEM to learn more. But before you do that, go support your favorite neighborhood spot. You'll be happy you did. I also want to talk to you about Surfshark, a virtual private network. It's like a secret tunnel on the internet that hides where you are and keeps your online stuff safe from strangers and makes you look like you're in another place so nobody can easily track what you're doing. Do you want every website that you go to knowing exactly where you are? I sure don't. And if you're in public, you're using the Wi-Fi at the coffee shop, at a hotel, people can hack into that stuff. So, no, you need a VPN. Another advantage, if content is geo-restricted, maybe certain websites are going to need special authentication in certain states in the future. Maybe you just want to watch the stuff that's available on British Netflix or Canadian Netflix just using your American account. A VPN can do that. Now, Surfshark is super easy. You can use it on an unlimited number of devices. They have over 3,000 servers in 100 countries and 24/7 customer support. I like how easy it is to turn on and off. So, for instance, when I go to my bank's website, I want them to know where I am so they don't get confused.
You'll be surprised at how cheap this is. It's got a 30-day money-back guarantee. And while you're checking it out, I also recommend Surfshark Antivirus. Go to surfshark.com/nakedly or use the code nakedly at checkout to get 4 extra months of Surfshark VPN. And you're going to forget that URL, so just look at the show notes for this episode, okay?
Well, I want to get the second song out there, another drama. So this is you picked from your last full album, Look Up 2015, Home Unknown, in part representing some of the work that you've done in the traditional Finnish folk area. Yeah, do you want to say a little about this before we hear it?
Yeah, you know, I grew up in a Finnish community and a Finnish family, and I always loved my Finnish heritage. And then when I turned about 40, I had a chance to play Finnish folk music professionally, where I was in a band called Kaivama, and we toured the country playing traditional music, and I got to play with some of Finland's best folk musicians.
All mandolin?
I was the auxiliary player, So I would play mandolin, acoustic guitar, piano, and harmonium. And then my collaborators were always fiddlers. So the fiddlers held down the melody and did all the classic tunes, and I was the accompanist. I was like the chord person supporting the melody person, you know? And in this tradition, there's no lyrics. It's an instrumental fiddle tradition that doesn't have singing. I absolutely loved that experience and to play that kind of music. I could feel that I wanted to express myself as a Finnish-American folk musician, but I don't play the fiddle and I don't know anything about folk dancing. I'm just a rock musician who was slumming it in the folk music world. And so I thought, well, I'm going to write a song in my own voice that's shaped by this experience of Nordic folk music. And I'm going to use all the Nordic folk instruments. So there's mandolins and mandolas, harmonium. And then I wrote this song. As I became a middle-aged person and really valuing my Finnish heritage, I realized that I feel a little bit homeless because I feel like I'm not quite an American. But then I go to Finland and I realize, oh my gosh, I'm not a Finn either. I'm in the no man's land. And so that's what this song is about.
I have never set my feet upon that rocky shoreline. I have never seen the sun down at the cold blue sea. I have never heard the wind in blood red birch leaves falling. Yet my heart is longing for my home unknown. In my dreams I follow the steps of my mother's mother's mother. There by the lakeside bellflowers grow beneath the wooden spire. I call out the name of my father's father's father. Can they hear? spoke your words and joined you in your singing. Generations later now, we've nothing left to say. Too much time has passed away, and all the words have vanished. Can I ever come back to my home? Oh, no.
All right, so that's harmonium that's doing the lead part, not melodica or something like that. That is.
That's correct. It's a harmonium, but it's obviously it's the same technology as a melodica because it's a keyboard instrument that's triggering reeds, mm-hmm. and the reeds have wind passing through. So, you know, the melodica is the plastic thing that you blow into with your mouth, but a harmonium that I have is from 1939, and it's a console instrument that you sit down and it has foot pedals. It's a pump organ. And so that's what you're hearing there. And in Finnish folk music, the harmonium is always in the rhythm section of the band. Sometimes it's the only rhythm section instrument, and sometimes it plays with an upright bass player.
So it's still harmonium when you have the places where chords enter to sort of thicken it up. That's just the bottom of the harmonium, is that right?
Correct. And everything you hear on that recording is one instrument and one performance, because I'm doing the low drones with my left hand, and I'm playing the melodic riffs and turnarounds with my right hand. With a pump organ like this, you use your knees to hit different levers that open up a volume and secondary octave, like ranks of an organ, just like a church organ would have, for example. So like you hit one key and you hear an octave, a low and a high note together. And so what you're hearing there on that recording is the, you know, super low droney stuff and the high melodic stuff and the swelling of the dynamics. It's all played live by me in the moment, even though it sounds like it could be three different instruments.
All right. Well, I will have to link folks and look myself for a good YouTube demonstration of the harmonium, because it's a very common instrument to see referenced, like in prog rock albums or whatever. And like, oh, you got your organ, you got your harmonium. I just assumed it was sort of another kind of organ. I know the sound, but like had no idea that it, you had to actually pump it with your feet or your legs or anything like this.
That's right. And I think the most famous rock harmonium is the Beatles' We Can Work It Out.
Yep, that makes sense.
And if you look on YouTube, if you search my name or and my band Kaivama or even some of my solo work, I have a lot of videos on my YouTube channel of me playing my harmonium. So you could go look at it. The instrument that I play is made by Estey, E-S-T-E-Y, which is the primary pump organ company in the 1900s in America. It's a Vermont company that made thousands and thousands of pump organs.
So this is just that and then mandolin on one side and mandola on the other side doing the arpeggios, is that?
Correct. Yep, that's right. And mandolin is super common in Finnish folk music, and mandola too, but that's just a weirder instrument, so not many people have them. But mandolin is a very regular part of a Finnish folk ensemble. And so, yes, what you're hearing is, yeah, the arpeggio with the low notes, because a mandola has the voicings of a viola. And, you know, in the mandolin family, the instruments correspond just like violins, because you have violin, viola, cello, and upright bass in the string, you know, the orchestra world. And mandolins have the exact same arrangement. You just need different size instruments. And I happen to have two. I have a mandolin and a mandola, so I can represent those two choices.
Saving up for the mandocello. Haven't bothered to do that.
Yes, I would love a mandocello. Oh my gosh, I think they're quite expensive. If you can find, they're out there, and even Gibson made mandocellos. But if you get one, it's going to cost you $5,000 or something.
Well, I see a banjo on the wall behind you. I mean, this is certainly the way that one of these instruments is, I would have thought maybe that it was banjo. Is there something specific about the way that it's plucked?
I haven't listened to the Home Unknown recording for a while, but I think I might be playing banjo on there as well.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Let's talk thematically and these images. there by the lakeside, bell flowers grow beneath the wooden spire. Like, what are you even talking about? Is this from when you were visiting? What's the wooden spire?
Well, the wooden spire is a church steeple.
Okay.
The flowers growing by the lakeside next to the church steeple of course, in Finland, almost every town looks like that because it's a country of lakes, just like Minnesota. Like, there's just tens of thousands of lakes all across the country. And then the little towns come up alongside the lake and you have, you know, the cemetery and the church and the downtown and all the different buildings of the little towns. And so when I visited my ancestral homes across Finland of my mom and dad's side of the family, that's so common to see the shoreline or the beach. Or if you go to the coastline, you know, you're at the Baltic Sea and you have the waves crashing on the big rocks. And then you've got the little town right there by the waterside and then the flowers along the way. And that's exactly what Finland looks like.
Well, in picking out bell flowers in particular, you know, which I would have to sort of look out exactly what, it's the kind of specificity that I would expect. For instance, they got married by the park, like not the name of a park, by Findlay Park, by whatever, you know, I expect something like that, that this is a more typical song thing. He put in a couple little specific details that have to have been because you were there, or...
I think that's been an important part of my songwriting ever since I started out as a 19-year-old or whatever, is that I love specific geographic and visual descriptions of the setting. Mm-hmm. And I think I learned that from James McMurtry. Have you had him on your show?
I have had him. He was very unresponsive in many ways. He was sort of notoriously irascible.
He's a little bit grumpy maybe, or just a little bit hard to dig into with. But I'm a huge fan. And his first record called Too Long in the Wasteland came out when I was a senior in high school. It's probably my top five favorite records of all time. And what I learned from McMurtry is you can tell more of a story by describing the town or describing the room or describing the weather than you can by actually telling the plot. And so what I'm always trying to do in my song is include a description like, what was the temperature? What was hanging on the wall? What color is the car? The more of that minutia. And also, I'm fascinated, like we talked about the other song, the mundane. I love mundane things, ordinary things, everyday things. And to describe the mundane in detail makes me super excited. And so a lot of my songs go into detail about the very ordinary, mundane things about life.
I've noticed the geographic references and the nature references much more common in Southern and Texan music in particular, that they really like their Texas. And so it almost seems like funny to hear somebody in the Midwest refer to going down to Hennepin County or whatever. Like, what are you talking
about?
That's
true. You're right. It is kind of a Texas songwriter thing, or a Nashville, or maybe a bluegrassy thing. But I think on this song, Home Unknown, is I'm deliberately using some of the tradition of Finnish folk music.
Yes.
And Finns are obsessed with nature. They're obsessed with the weather. They're obsessed with trees. They're obsessed with water. And in many, many of the Finnish folk songs that do have lyrics, there is always nature descriptions. And so I'm really doing that on purpose, to sort of uphold the tradition.
The rocky shoreline, the cold blue sea, the blood red birch leaves falling. Right. So very specific nature stuff. But then second verse is a dream. You're not literally going there and calling out anybody's name. Do you even know the name of your father's father's father? Or is that part of the thing that you don't actually...
I think that's one of the mysteries of the song, is it's the home unknown. Because the whole point of the song is I have never seen the wind through the trees. I've never stood at the rocky shoreline. So it's this person who knows all about their ancestral homeland. They've pictured it. They've talked about it. They know their grandpa and their great grandpa, but they've never been there themselves. So they find themselves homesick for a place they've never been. And that's the heartbreak of the song, is this person knows, has a vision of this place, their true home, but it's not theirs. They've never been there. They don't live there. And then, of course, by the end of the song, you realize they don't even speak the language. And so they are really a person without a home.
Too much time has passed and all the words have vanished. No amount of historical research will yield. Clearly not all the words have vanished. You know, you have, but I guess, you know, what would actually make it emotionally resonant?
I think what I'm saying in that line is my grandparents, who could speak Finnish, did not teach my mom and dad. Hmm. And so when the boomers came along, the language disappeared for the Finnish Americans. And then when I'm a Gen Xer, when I came along in 1971, no one was left to teach me how to speak Finnish. So my grandparents broke the chain, and you know, too much time has passed away and all the words have vanished. It's like, literally, I can't speak that language anymore. And when I go there now to visit my cousins and stuff, we have to speak English together because I can't meet them in my own family language.
So you hit this instrumental section, which goes on for a full minute in the middle. So is the pattern of the lyrics sort of set by, like, it does sound like you're reciting the pace at which the words are coming out. It sounds as if you are reciting something from a liturgy or something
exactly.
Like that.
Exactly. Okay. You're hearing exactly what's happening because I wrote the song as if it was a hymn or liturgical music or classical music. The reason it worked like that is because this is one of the examples in my catalog where I had the entire music first. I had all the chords and the entire melody and actually wrote this song on the piano and I notated it on staff paper.
Wow.
So it looked like a hymnal, or it looked like sheet music for a piano arrangement. And then I thought, okay, this is the song. I knew it was called Home Unknown, but I didn't have any lyrics. And so then I had to write lyrics that fit the melodic thing down to the quarter note. And so there's no syncopation. There's no variation in the meter. And if you were to map out verses 1, 2, and 3, you would find that the meter matches exactly. Just like if you looked in a hymnal, there's no irregularity or no like free emotional expression of stretching out words or phrases. It is like a math problem, and it sits in there with ultimate regularity. And because I wanted it to subconsciously suggest that this is a song from 200 years ago, or that it behaves more like a hymn than a pop song.
All right, well, with that in mind, I want to play part of the second verse. So this is the father's father's father part.
I call out the name of my father's father's father. Can they hear me calling to my home unknown?
Yeah, because I thought, if you were writing lyrics first or setting the lyrics, like, why is father's father's father? Like, that's just a weird place to put in.
Right.
Or even calling out the name, you're not connoting the calling out by just extending the name there. I don't know. It is not quite alliterative, but even though that it is suggesting, like, you know, the fact that you're lengthening name sort of suggests the calling out, but not,
yeah,
not enough,
right.
not in a very literal way. Let's put that.
Yeah. I love that you noticed that, because I want the listener to think, like, this doesn't sound like a rock and roll song. It sounds like it's out of time, or it's from a different era, or it's, I wanted sort of a timeless, transcending the time continuum. And, you know, as I've gotten older, I've gotten more interested in church music and liturgical music and more formal composition. So I think a lot of my songs, even the rock songs, there's songs on like the Waves album, for example. Like, there's a really heavy rock song called Oxygen Tank, which is probably the heaviest song I've ever recorded. But I wrote the lyrics in the same way, where they are following a meter that is a very rigid mathematical pattern. And they repeat 3 times in a row, just like a hymn would, or like this song does. So I'm getting more into that with age. I think it's just the influence of being so interested in German chorales and church music.
What I was going to ask about the instrumental section, it seems like you've addressed, because the whole thing was really instrumental. You know, that it's not just, we're going to bring back the harmonium lead like you had at the beginning. We're going to, first the mandolin's going to take the lead, then you're going to hand it back to the harmonium, and you're going to sort of pass this back and forth.
Right.
Then the last time through, well, it's a harmonium again, but it's double stopped. It's not just the single note thing anymore.
Exactly. Yes, that's correct.
That this is just some, like, a build in a classical piece. It's not, this would be a little strange if this was a pop song and you're like, okay, let's do the break for the guitar solo. But instead of that, we're going to have guitar to keyboard to guitar to keyboard. You know, that would be because you have players in the band that you need to let wank around for a while, but like, that's clearly right. Not what's going on here.
Right. It's arranged like that because this is the Finnish folk music tradition. And in Finnish instrumental folk music, what you have is a melody. And oftentimes it's an A section and a B section. And that comprises the piece itself. And then the band will say, like at a dance or at a concert, they would do the form four times or like four loops, like A, B, A, B, A, B, A, B. And so maybe they would play it regular. Loop number one would be regular. Loop number two would be regular. Loop number three, the accordion would take the lead instead of the fiddle. And then loop number four, the fiddle and the accordion would harmonize till the end. That's how Finnish folk bands can take a regular, of quite a simple melody that only has two sections and stretch it out to make it a 3 or 4 minute performance. And so what I'm doing is I'm saying, okay, this song has sort of an A section. I would have to look to see if it has a B section. It might be just one big A section, but I'm doing four loops of it. So it's like verse, verse. The third loop is the solo, but it's not even really a solo. It's just that the instruments take the melody from the vocalist. And then you get back to the fourth loop and the vocalist re-enters and summarizes the whole piece with the final singing.
Yes, if there were a B section, it would be exactly that part. I call it the name of my father's father because the verse has four lines, you know, so you get the first half of it and that, you know, the B section is just the second half of the verse.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Well, let's get an actual pop song out there. Tape, the opening track from your 1997 album Recital. I wanted to have something that was a little old here, and this is a much more straightforward jangle pop thing with a nice harmonica lead and some organs against that. And yeah, can you say a little about that before we hear it?
Yes, this was the big hit, I suppose, from my album Recital, which came out in 1997. And I moved from the West Coast to Chicago in the summer of 2006. And this was the first song I wrote when I became a Chicagolander, when I returned to my beloved Midwest and I'd moved to the big city. And of course, in Chicago, the traffic is terrible. I had a Mazda Protege, a red Mazda with a sunroof and a tape deck inside. And so on the passenger seat, I had a shoebox filled with my favorite albums on cassette. And I'd go out driving through Chicago and I would sit in traffic, just like you'd be on the, you know, on the tollway, bumper to bumper, nobody moving. You know, it took an hour to drive 5 miles in Chicago. And so I just listened to tapes in the car just constantly. And so this was the first song I wrote, kind of getting used to my new life in the city with all this horrible traffic. And it's got that, like, when I'm out in rush hour and I can't escape, whatever that lyric is about, I'll play your tape.
For things that never fail, bless just five blank cassettes and a U.S. mail. You sit down at your drums, you pick up your guitar, you make me a tape to play in my car. When I'm out in rush hour and I can't escape, you pick up your guitar, you make me a tape to play in my car. When I'm out in rush hour and I can't escape, I don't mind the traffic, no, 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 when I play your tape.
All right, so very nice, happy tune. I, of course, love the subject matter. We are exactly the same age. So we...
All right.
All my first albums, I had a Tascam 4-track. We did introduce a DAT machine to master 2, you know, to do the initial mixes 2, so they wouldn't just completely... But before that, it was even like, I guess every copy of it had to be... I don't remember how we mass produced before I had the DAT machine, because you don't want to, you know, be remixing it every time or something. You know. But yes, I think it was like mixed to a master cassette.
Yeah.
And then you would use the cassette copy feature on the dual tape deck, and made many, many, you know, not only demos, but just mixtapes for people. It was just I did not have as much time as I pretended to have, given the amount of mixtapes I made for people. So it was always like, yeah, you own a lot of vinyl, but like, what can you do with that? You can't bring that in the car. That's ridiculous. Even the CDs, like, well.
This song is a real snapshot of what it's like to be a Gen Xer in the 80s and 90s, where, you know, sharing cassette tapes with your friends and collaborators was an absolutely huge part of life, and really a really awesome thing, you know? I've discovered so many of my favorite albums and favorite bands because of somebody made me a mixtape, and I would say, wow, I've never heard this artist, I'd never heard this song before, and then I would become a giant fan.
I moved to Madison up from Texas in 2000. It's around the same time you were kind of doing that trip across.
Yeah, because I lived in Chicago in 2000. I would play in Madison all the time. There were coffee houses and bars that I would play in Madison. So yeah, we probably crossed paths. I would go to shows at the Barrymore Theater. And exactly that. I saw the Silos at the Crystal Corner in Madison in 1997 or something like that. So yeah, I was in Madison a lot.
And when I got here, I still was in meeting new musicians, like, you know, I had some CDs that I could give them that full albums, but if I wanted to demo here's new songs, it would be giving them cassette tapes. And even at that point, people were like, I don't know that I can play
this. Right.
I don't have a cassette, you know. It was not a given that everybody had access to this. So it really changed how, you know, now that we can just run off a mix and FTP it or whatever, that it's not a big deal anymore. But yeah, so very nostalgic as far as this goes. Yeah, you want to say anything about sort of the, I don't know, if I were recording this, I probably would have made it faster just because I have too much energy on my hands that you had. It's got a nice, very relaxed, it's a good old time song, as opposed to just the, you know.
Yeah, I think when I play it live, it might be a little faster. But you're right, as you know, I haven't listened to it for a while, but when you just played that clip, I thought, wow, it's pretty chill, pretty mid-tempo. That opening drum fill is really laying back, you know?
And then we play the transition at the end of the first verse, so...
And hitting play. You sit down at your drums, you pick up your guitar.
Then we have the little bass spiky. I don't know, is bass sort of a more primary instrument? What was the order? Did you sort of start playing bass and guitar at the same time? Or are you more of a bass guy, really?
I'm not a bass guy.
Okay.
That part was played by John Kearns, actually, one of my collaborating friends on that particular recording. I played bass on a lot of my earlier stuff, but I'm a guitar player faking it. And as I get older, the best recordings I've made always have a real bass player doing the bass parts.
And so what, like with that, which is clearly a little melodic riff that's carrying you out, was that the kind of thing you would have in mind and you would dictate, or you really just let...
Well, okay. I trusted him to do it, but he knows what I like, and I think he and I have a lot of the same instincts. And I tend to like busy bass parts, and I like melodic bass parts and unusual, but I think maybe it's because I like REM, and Mike Mills is such an unusual bassist, and he does a lot of riffy melodic stuff. And so that's kind of my preference for bass. And so if the bass player is real busy, that's fine with me.
And just the level of pause that you have in that it's not like a really attention grabbing, everything shoop, and then we right. continue. It's not that kind of thing. There's still some things sort of running over it, just a little more subtle choices.
Yeah. You know, when I wrote this song and recorded it, it immediately kind of became the hit from that record. It got played on the radio. And then the coolest thing that happened with it was it appeared on the Paste Magazine sampler, the very first Paste sampler. I don't know if you remember when Paste Magazine used to do those. And so I was on this sampler that went out to, you know, I don't know how many thousands of copies they sold, but it really boosted my career. It gave me an audience, a national audience, where I had pretty much been hanging in the Midwest most of the time. Even now, I'll be on tour, like in California or Texas or someplace far away, and someone will come up to me at a show and go, "Oh my gosh, I discovered you because that song Tape was on the Paste sampler." So that was a really cool exposure for me. And it was all because this song is, you know, it's super catchy and the audience always just really responds great to it. And it's super fun to play.
Let me play from where I had listed as the chorus breakdown, which you'd think that this is sort of as a jangle pop thing that there would be electric guitar throughout, but I don't know that there is. Like, I think this might be the first place that it comes in.
You sit down at your drums, you pick up your guitar, you make me a tape to play in my car.
I was trying to listen whether when the band comes back in, whether then you have roaring guitar, like the guitar that's been chuck chuck ching, but I don't think so. I think you just introduced it and then it goes.
That part, that electric guitar part, was added by the mixing engineer, Matt Patrick, who did the mix. He didn't even ask my opinion or ask it. He just said, "Here's a mix I made. I put a little guitar in the breakdown." I was like, "That sounds awesome." So it's kind of doing the Rick Springfield,
yeah,
you know, thing there, which I love. So yeah, I think it was a great move. I love when an instrument comes in the middle of a song and then goes away. Like if it just appears for 8 bars and then you never hear it again, like that's a cool trick in production.
All right, so we would normally be nearing the end of the interview and introducing the last thing, but I felt like there's this whole other dimension to your music, this Sound Theology album, which you say actually from the way that it is presented on Spotify as what's the 10th anniversary edition, or this is a clever way of representing old albums by adding, as opposed to just sneaking them in and saying that they were released back then and don't, you know, not acknowledging the fact that you remastered or whatever. But I assumed that this was sort of a compilation of stuff that you had done in your church work or whatever over, because this is what, 47, it's a ridiculous number of songs.
The original version of the album came out in 2000, and it was a double CD with 52 songs, and there was one song for each week of the liturgical calendar. And so the church calendar starts with Advent 1, and then it goes 52 weeks around the calendar. So it was a concept album where you put on disc 1, if you listen to a song a week, then the songs correspond with all the festival days of the church calendar. And yeah, it was 52 songs released all at once, recorded all at once as one record. And actually, when I made that record, I thought this is probably going to be the end of my career because it's just too weird and it's just going to alienate everybody. But it turned out to be the biggest thing I ever did and got the best press and the most attention, and it blew up my audience to 5 times as big as it was before. So
because you found a niche that was, you know, oh, there are actually a lot of people. It's not Jesus music in the sense of praise you, praise you, praise you. Like it right. is much more idiosyncratic and personal for the most part, or just like, you know, a guy thinking who some of the building blocks that you think with are drawn from studying the Bible, or like you got the work in my church committee. Like it seems like such a dweeby sort of like if you're writing songs about your office. and like exactly. and giving them to your office mates, talking about how the manager is annoying or whatever. That
right. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And like I mentioned before, I'm fascinated by ordinary life and minutiae. And so the whole record was about the minutiae of being a church-going person. And what I'm interested in, more than songs about God or songs about Jesus, I'm more interested in songs about the church, songs about religious practice, songs about the behind the scenes, you know, because there's enough people in the world writing devotional music about God or about their faith.
Sure.
But there's almost no, especially in rock music, there's no rock music about religion itself or about the church or about what it's like to go to church. And so that's what it was exciting to me. And there, you know, there are people who've done that well. Like one of my favorite bands is the Rainmakers, 80s band, and they have a lot of songs that are about religion. But they're not devotional songs about God. Mm-hmm. I got so excited. You know who else does that really well is T-Bone Burnett. Mm. You know, he has lots of songs that are sort of theologically observant, but they're not devotional music. That really appeals to me. And so when I released this record, turns out there was a giant audience out there for that kind of stuff.
I'm attracted to, you know, traditional blues tunes and stuff like that might include gospel elements. But even as a non-believer that I will throw in, you know, just as an expression, it is among the things that are floating around my subconscious. So the one that I was attracted to here is toward the end of the album, Failing Rockstar Attempt, not only because it's just a really interesting message, it's a very short song. It establishes itself, but it's one of the weirdest musically that you have. You have most of your stuff is much more like tape. It's very tasteful. It's not going to alienate anyone, but this one is more like what I was writing in the 90s. And so,
you know, in my whole career, I love doing interviews. I love doing press, and no one has ever asked me about Failing Rockstar Attempt until today. So I'm thrilled to talk about it because I love the song. And, you know, I've never, ever performed it live. I wrote it and recorded it and put it out and then have never, ever played it live. I think I would need a really good band and we'd have to learn it from the record. We'd have to figure out how in the heck do you play this weird song. So, yeah, it's never been played live and I've never talked about it in public until right now.
Okay, so it's got kind of a 90s grunge thing. I mean, as those things, even the guitar tone is still measure it. You're not making anybody's ears bleed with this.
Right.
Again, it's you and your harmony of yourself, but it's sort of in the most, they might be giants, kind of pointy.
Yeah, nasal.
Kind of irritating.
Yes, exactly. This song was written in a really interesting way. I've tried writing songs every way you could possibly imagine. And the way this one came about, I remember vividly. I wrote this with my friend, David Casimir, who actually lives in Madison. He's a lawyer. He's a friend of mine from childhood, a very versatile musician and creative person. And so we were hanging out actually in Madison back in about 1999, and we were talking about songwriting, and we thought, well, it'd be kind of cool if we wrote a song where the chord changes were generated randomly. And so I think what we did is, you know how on the musical scale, it goes from A up to G, and those are the letters you have to work with. And so Dave and I randomly generated different combinations of chords. And I remember what they were for this song. The first B-E-D was one. And then F-E-C was one, and E-G-G was one. We thought, okay, we've generated these groups of chords. Now we're going to write sections that follow these chords. But we realized, okay, playing a B major chord and a D chord, it's weird. So we made it like B-flat, E-flat, and D minor is the first group. And then E-flat, G-G, or maybe E-flat and two G minors. I can't exactly remember. So then we wrote chord progressions and riffs that followed these randomly generated chord shapes. So then we had like three sections of the song. Our recording device was a Sony mini-disc four-track machine that Dave had. What you're hearing is me playing the drums and Dave playing the guitar, and we do one pass. And then we open up the second track, and it's Dave playing bass and me harmonizing the guitar in the second pass. So that's track two. And then there's two tracks left on the four-track machine. And then I took the instrumental performance home, and I thought, oh, I got to make a song out of this. I have two tracks on the four-track machine remaining. Here, I'll show you. I have this book. I keep hardbound books with lyric ideas and with song titles. And so I'll fill a page with like 200 ideas for interesting song titles. And I had in my list, Failing Rockstar Attempt. I thought, okay, that's a cool title. This song is going to be called Failing Rockstar Attempt. And then I listened to the music that Dave and I recorded, and I wrote a melody that fit into those chords. And then, so on track three, I sang the lead vocal, and on track four, I harmonized. And that is what you are hearing. So the song was really written in reverse, where you started with music and riffs, but no melody. And then I had to come up with what is this song about? And then I had to write a melody that fit into the recording that was made.
That is way more information than people typically remember from a song this distance from us chronologically.
25 years ago. Yeah.
Just to finish things up, I should also call attention. I will link folks to some of the stuff from A Heartland Liturgy, which is a different. So that's, did that album actually come out in 2015, the same as your last?
The digital online version was 2015, but the first version, the physical CD, came out in 2006.
Okay. Your most listened to album on Spotify is Soul Adorn Yourself with Gladness, which is, so these are not songs that you wrote from scratch, at least for the most part, but that you are using. When somebody is a professional musician, usually they cannot actually get away with just, you know, recording their own stuff. They have to teach, they have to run a studio.
Right.
And so is this being in church bands doing, like, how did this, was this an extension of your hobby, or was this like another sort of the day job part of your musical life?
It was me just following my creative muse.
Okay.
I think it was really after the Sound Theology album, I realized, wow, people are really interested in sort of church music and done in sort of a rock and roll garagey kind of approach. And so I thought, you know, would it be interesting if I could compose a whole liturgical setting using sort of the ancient forms of, you know, Kyrie, Gloria, all the really old musical forms that make up liturgical music. And so that's what the Heartland Liturgy was me being a liturgical composer. And then I had extra room on what was going to be the CD. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to do my own arrangement of some classic hymns from 500 years ago. For example, Soul Adorn Yourself with Gladness is a German chorale from the 1600s. And the tune is Johann Kruger, super famous classical composer. So I wrote this arrangement that's more like an Americana bluegrass version of that hymn. And I tacked it onto my liturgy album. And I did a couple other hymns as well. And then once it went up on the streaming services in 2015, because Soul Adorn Yourself with Gladness is a world famous German chorale that tons of classical musicians everywhere around the world would know, It immediately became my biggest download because no one's looking for it because of me. They're looking for it because it's a famous classical composition. And so it's just funny. That's the nature of the streaming services, is you can get a hit that you didn't write yourself and that you would never play live, you know?
Well, and that clearly you're comfortable with just, this is your brand. It has these multiple branches to it, as opposed to I'm going to come up with a band name or an alternate name. And just to put the stuff that's more religious out, it's a different audience. I'm going to just, I don't want my most listened to thing, period, to be this, because then people are going to think I'm that kind of guy.
Exactly. Yes. That was a decision I had to make, is do I want Jonathan Runman, the rock singer, to have sort of this other stuff going on? Because really, I have three careers that happen at once. My first career is rock songwriter, and my second career is Lutheran church musician, and my third career is Finnish folk musician. And they're totally different, and they have totally different audiences. And so I had to choose, do I just want to be Jonathan Runman, or do I want to change my name or have a band name so that no one gets confused? But ultimately, I decided to be like, you know, a few jazz musicians, they just use their name and they'll make any kind of record and they don't care.
Sure.
And the same is true with bluegrass musicians. If you think about Bela Fleck, right? Bela Fleck will make a bluegrass record and then he'll make a jazz record with the Fleck Tones and then he'll make a classical record with Yo-Yo Ma, but it's all Bela Fleck. And I love that. And so I thought, you know what? This is me. I love all this kind of music. I will not be bound by genre. And I'm just going to put my name on everything. And if it's confusing, then so be it.
All right. So all that was sort of bonus. It'll be in the real episode. But I did want to leave here since, you know, we're promoting the new album and the song you picked from it is not a new song. I saw that you were especially excited about in your press release about Evidence. So we're going to just to say goodbye here. Let's briefly introduce one more song from the new album, Waves. Evidence, that apparently you wrote right before you had these sessions and just seemed like a big inspiration.
I usually don't write a lot by inspiration. It's usually pretty calculated. And I had a plane ticket. I was flying to Nashville to make this record and I wanted one more song. And about a week before I was going to fly to Nashville, this song arrived. And I think it might be my favorite on the whole record.
Well, excellent. Thanks so much for chatting.
Yeah, Mark, this was a blast. You know, I'm a fan of your show. I discovered your show because of Steve Dawson, because I did a lot of shows with him in the 90s and with Dolly Varden, his band. And then when I listened to Steve, and then I went back and I thought, you have so many of my all-time favorite people, Sam Phillips, Peter Case. These are my heroes. And so I've listened to a lot of your shows, and a lot of the people you have on are my all-time favorites.
Well, I appreciate it. Here it is, Evidence.
Days are getting shorter now, so I will take no rest.